And don't pay any attention to what Lord Henry says. He has a bad influence over his friends, with the single exception of myself.
Have you really a bad influence, Lord Henry?
There's no such thing as a good influence, Mr. Gray. All influence is immoral.
Why?
Because the aim of life is self-development, to realize one's nature perfectly. That's what we're here for. A man should live out his life fully and completely, give form to every feeling, expression to every thought, reality to every dream. Every impulse that we suppress broods in the mind and poisons us. There's only one way to get rid of a temptation, and that's to yield to it. Resist it, and the soul grows sick with longing for the things it has forbidden to itself. There's nothing that can cure the soul but the senses. Just as there is nothing that can cure the senses but the soul.
Turn your head a little more to the left, Dorian.
The gods have been good to you, Mr. Gray.
Why do you say that?
Because you have the most marvelous youth, and youth is the one thing worth having.
I don't feel that, Lord Henry.
No, you don't feel it now, but someday you will feel it terribly. What the gods give, they quickly take away. Time is jealous of you, Mr. Gray. Don't squander the gold of your days. Live. Let nothing be lost upon you. Be afraid of nothing. There is such a little time that your youth will last, and you can never get it back. As we grow older, our memories are haunted by the exquisite temptations we hadn't the courage to yield to. The world is yours for a season. It would be tragic if you realized too late, as so many others do, that there is only one thing in the world worth having, and that is youth.
Dorian Gray had never heard the praise of folly so eloquently expressed. The creed of pleasure soared into a philosophy of life, while Dorian stood as if he were under a spell. He felt afraid of Lord Henry's ideas and ashamed of himself for being afraid. It was as if he were learning to know himself for the first time, as if a stranger had revealed his own most secret thoughts to him. For the first time, he became conscious of his youth and conscious of the fact that one day he would lose it.
My visit to you hasn't been wasted, Basil. I found a rare and beautiful...
Hello and welcome to Book Versus Movie. This is a podcast where we read books that have been adapted into movies, and then we try to decide which we like better, the book or the movie. I am Margot P. of ColoniaBook.com, and this is my good friend and co-host, Margot D. of Brooklyn Fit Chick.
Hi, everyone.
Happy October.
We love the spooky movies.
This is my favorite time of year in San Diego. October and November is my favorite. It's not that cold. It's like in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just enough of a change.
Same in Brooklyn. It's the best.
Yeah. Ugh. So if you're new to the show, every October we do spooky books and movies. Since we've been in this pandemic time, we've been doing a brand new episode every single week. And that means we always are looking for ideas for new books and movies that we can do. And there are several places where you can suggest books and movies, or if you want to just say hi, interact with the two of us or other listeners of this podcast. There's a couple places where you can do that on the internet.
Yes, we have a basic Facebook page. Be sure to like that. But we also have a private Facebook group, and that's where a lot of people like to interact and talk with us. And you just have to type in Book vs Movie Podcast Group in Facebook, and literally we just talk about books and movies there. It's a nice spot. People exchange ideas, and we've used song lyrics. We've done novellas, plays, magazine articles, you name it. So we're looking for suggestions for December, because we've done all the majors pretty much, I think. So anyway, that's a place you can reach out to us. Also on Twitter and Instagram, you write out Book Versus and Movie. If you want to send us an old-timey email, it's Book Versus Movie Podcast, spell it all out, @gmail.com. And I haven't mentioned the last few weeks, though, we have lots of stickers. So if you would like some stickers to put on your laptop or whatever, send us an email, bookversusmoviepodcast@gmail.com.
Yes, thank you so much. Yeah, we really need holiday suggestions. I mean, we've done all the standards, then all the like second tier, like it just takes place during the holidays. You know, your diehards.
Yeah.
So yeah, please, if you have a book and movie suggestions that are holiday related that we can cover in December, we are all ears. I'm very excited to talk about today's book and movie. I don't think I've ever seen this movie, and yet I've read the book several times. We're going to be talking about Oscar Wilde, I think his only novel, if I remember.
Yes.
Oscar Wilde's Picture of Dorian Gray.
But first, we should just say thank you to Joe, who joined our Patreon page. All of the we've been doing the show for 7 years now. That I think it's 7 years. Everything from 2019 and then previous to that is going up on the Patreon wall. Much up there is free. Just for a few dollars a month, if you wanted to help us out, it'd be really great. So just go to Patreon, type in Book vs Movie Podcast. And Joe, thank you so much for doing that. We just put up Coraline, which is a really popular one. So anyway, yes, Oscar Wilde. Are we ready for Wilde? I don't know.
Okay, here's where, again, I think we should say that we're not, like, literature majors mm-hmm. or film school graduates of any kind, but because this is a big Oscar Wilde, you know, I mean, you could have a whole podcast just about this guy. It's a long, epic life. Lots of stuff happens. We're just going to be hitting the broad strokes here. I mean, this is a very famous book. Even if you've never read The Picture of Dorian Gray, you probably know, like, the basis of the story and the premise. And it's something that has just, I think, kind of instantly got absorbed into the popular culture. It was kind of an instant hit. But we'll talk about that in just a minute. Let's talk a little bit about Oscar Wilde.
He was born 1854 in Dublin, Ireland. He lived to just be 46 years old. He was very tall and very striking looking. He was openly bisexual, and he was married and he had kids. He was a philosopher. He was a poet. He's written several plays. This is his only novel, and it's more like a novella, the one we're talking about today. He was famously arrested for having homosexual relations with other men, and they used this material to back it up. This was an article that appeared in a magazine, Lippincott's magazine.
Lippincott, yeah.
Magazine. He went to jail for a few years, 2 years for hard labor, sorry, came out of it, and he always was kind of a delicate soul. And his heart didn't manage to live that much longer.
I mean,
and you would
first
be
of all, like, yeah, you would be. It's a Victorian prison. Like, is there anything more grim?
Right.
I mean, that and like the Spanish Inquisition. Like, isn't that horrible, horrible conditions. I don't know if I mentioned this last week or not. I have read the entire works of Oscar Wilde.
Wow.
I've read everything. When I was a teenager, again, this was before smartphones or the internet or things of that nature, we went on a long, like a month-long family vacation when I was in high school. And so I brought a couple of books with me. And one of the books that I brought was the complete works of Oscar Wilde, which was like about, you know, 3.5 inches thick.
Wow.
And I read the thing cover to cover. So I've read every single word he's ever written. He is such a fun read.
Yes.
He's known for being, you know, his wit is something that, you know, once you read Oscar Wilde, you know, everything that comes after him just seems like they're trying to copy him. He's so witty and so fast and so clever. And he was also a famous, what do I want to say, kind of arbiter of good taste, mm-hmm. decor and fashion and stuff like that. And he toured the U.S., speaking about, you know, the trends in art, literature, and you know, design, just one of these forces of nature. It's so hard to believe that he died at 46.
Yeah,
when you read all of the things that he accomplished, because he comes from like fairly humble beginnings.
Yeah,
really.
Yeah, but he was a very striking figure. Like I said, he was very tall. He had kind of this wavy hair. He was into the late. He was, I guess, a bit of a dandy. He liked to dress up. He liked to hang around smart people, and he liked to chat. And he was really this is so amazing about this novel that we're talking about, Dorian Gray, is that he went to dinner. I was watching everything about Oscar Wilde the other night. I went crazy on YouTube. And Stephen Fry, who plays Oscar Wilde in a couple of different movies, talks about that he and Sir Arthur Conan Doyle and Oscar Wilde go to dinner. And they say, let's come up with ideas for books. And, you know,
yeah, like with the editor of Lippincott, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
And so it's, and it was a big deal to get in these magazines. They paid really well. You know, everybody read them and they were like very thick. They were big, big reads. And so they came up with these ideas and Sherlock Holmes was one of those stories. And then this is the other story. And it was did very well. And then but it was considered so racy for the time that the it was published in monthly installments that they would try to take things back. And it, there's a lot of allusion to drug use and to homosexuality and same-sex attraction, which Victorian England blew their minds. It was not subtext.
No. I had forgotten. Like, I hadn't read it in a few years, you know, and I had forgotten how very homoerotic this book is. It, like, it is overt.
Yeah.
It's like... It's all out there. And yeah, he's not kidding.
No,
he's real serious. And, I mean, and it's lovely. I mean, the language and the whole thing is such a beautiful read. But yeah, the drug use,
the aesthetics,
the whole thing. There's just passages of describing, you know, so-and-so's house and such the gown and the opera that they went to see and the play that they went to see and just it's so fun. It's such a fun world to like dive into for a little bit.
And it was this idea of libertines, which is that you just live free, live your best life, live to your truth, basically, is what you say now.
Even if people get hurt.
Yeah. Well, art for art's sake. It's supposed to hurt sometimes, you know, that's what it is. You're only on this planet for a short amount of time. Make the most of it. These old Victorian rules are a drag and they're keeping us outdated from the rest of the world. And he felt like that's what he gives to this character. And there's one version. So they've going back and forth between Lippincott's magazine. And then there was a publisher who published the book. And then it was like a big deal to get Oscar Wilde book. It was still considered racy. There is one version that he says he's totally fine with. That's what he wanted. And of all places, it's at the Morgan Library in New York City. So, you know, Sonia Morgan on Real Housewives of New York, when she talks at the Morgan Library.
I forgot she's a Morgan.
She's a Morgan. Yeah. This is at the Morgan Library. And that's like, you can make an appointment to see it for yourself. But he was constantly, they were trying to get him to edit. And he was like, no, they're going to an opium den and they're going to do and that. Yes.
These men are in love.
Yes. You know, consequences be damned. Like, they're just going to do it. And that's the story. It comes out in 1890 and he dies 10 years later. He after this comes out, he goes on trial. The first trial ends in miscarriage, whatever they call that. And then he was tried again. He was sentenced to 2 years of hard labor. It was a dramatic fall from someone who hung out with Baudelaire and all these other people.
Quite something.
Yeah.
And the thing was, like, he was the guy. He was the Kim Kardashian of his, like, Kim Kardashian with a literary mind, you know, just spouting off these witticisms and timeless sayings.
Is
left
it Fran
and right.
Lebowitz that I'm thinking of? Fran Lebowitz?
Like Fran Lebowitz. Exactly. Yes.
That's it.
Only on a higher, like, he cared way more about how he looks than Fran Lebowitz.
You combine Kim Kardashian and Fran Lebowitz, try to put that together.
Yes, exactly.
What would that mean?
And it's a man. Yeah, I mean, he and just people, it was such a status thing, like, to have him come to your party and have him, like, expound, you know, his thoughts on anything at your salon that you were hosting. And to go from that to, like, the grimmest, grimiest brutality laden day after day slog of being in a Victorian prison, and also the whole scandal on the way. I mean, he, if I remember correctly, so he was having this relationship. This was after the publication of Dorian Gray, which was a smash hit, as we said. He's in this relationship, and he has a lot of relationships with men, and he's married and has a family, by the way, to a woman. He's married to a woman. This one young man that he, and if you watch the movie that Stephen Fry, I think it's just called Wild.
Yeah.
and it's Stephen Fry, and Jude Law is the young man. And the thing is, this young man was from an aristocratic family. And
Goldie? What was his name?
No, he had a nickname that he called him. Mm-hmm. Douglas, I want to say, was his real name, but right. His last name. But I can't remember what the nickname was that he had for him. Anyway, so he's having this relationship with this very hot young man. And
beautiful, the guy is, by the way.
Really good-looking young man.
Jude Law plays him. That gives you an idea how good-looking this kid was.
I mean, and it's like, I'm not sure that the young man, that Jude Law is like, he's almost doing him justice. Like, this guy's super good-looking.
Yeah.
Anyway, the young man's family... I can't remember exactly what it was. If they just went around talking about Oscar Wilde, mm-hmm. And kind of spreading rumors like this guy's a real bad influence on our son and, you know, stay away from him, keep your sons away from him. You know, just this guy's Oscar Wilde is bad news. And Oscar Wilde, the other thing is that he had like a huge ego.
Yes.
And so... that probably would have got blown over because Oscar Wilde was super famous and everybody super popular. Like, you know, the fact that people were talking about him behind his back kind of lent to the mystique of him. It wasn't really hurting him is what I'm saying. But because he has this ego, if I'm remembering correctly, he decides to sue the guy's family for slander.
I think it began that way. Yes.
And that kicks off this whole... like, he's like, you know, I'm going to sue you for slander. And they're like, oh, yeah, well, we're going to sue you for being a homosexual. And then it, like, really blows up. And he ends up in jail.
And there's another friend. It started just before that. It was another one of those great thinkers. And he was saying that, you know, Oscar Wilde steals a lot of ideas from him. And then that started getting...
oh, that's right.
That's a rumor that got out there. So maybe not all those bon mots were his.
It's like... you know, we talked today about cancel culture and, you know, taking people down. Like, this was, like, that makes the stuff that we talk about today about cancel culture look like, you know, schoolyard taunts.
Yeah, kindergarten stuff. Yeah.
This was epic and brutal. And it really killed him. I mean, it really shortened his life.
I think that's what it was. I mean, it was that argument. It was also, let's be clear, the drinking and the drugs and the hard living did him no favors.
It was a bit of a party lifestyle.
19th century medicine, you know. He goes to, and we're talking about hard labor and how far he had fallen. When he was changing jails at one point, they had to take him by a train, and he went off the train, and then he went on to this other platform, and these people were just making fun of him and taunting him because he was very tall. He stood out in a crowd.
He was unusually tall.
Yes. Yeah. So he just had to hear that. And then he got out, and he lived for a few more years, but he was nowhere where he used to be. He just couldn't, he didn't have the energy to put on a performance.
No, I think it really damaged his health.
Yeah.
I mean, and again, the lifestyle, but you know, that prison is notoriously awful, brutal, violent. And he dies in Paris. Mm-hmm. If I remember correctly, I haven't looked at this in a long time, but I kind of remember that, you know, he still had friends who were kind of helping him, you know, it was nothing like what he had, but, you know, he did still have like a sort of a society life where he could expound and he did still write. He was still writing after that. He famously wrote The Ballad of Reading Jail, which is absolutely gorgeous. If you've never read The Ballad of Reading Jail, it is a beautiful, tragic, epic poem, account of what he experienced and what he saw in that jail. It's just gorgeous. It's really beautiful.
He also has The Importance of Being Earnest, which was a huge smash hit play that's still performed. to the States.
Oh, all the time. His works are performed all the time.
All the time. And if you go around, especially England and Ireland, you can see him everywhere. His influence is everywhere. So this is the story that we're talking about today. And like we said, we're not experts. I mean, we've heard from the people who are experts Daphne du Maurier
term paper.
Yes.
You are not in the right place.
It's this, and also he had an interest. It's funny, and I could see this now that I just watched the movie, and this is just a few years before he died that he published this, maybe about 10 years before he died. Not exactly a religious man, but he had an interest in Catholicism, and I think he had an interest in, I'm sure it was all about the fact that...
The morality of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And confession, you know, maybe that, you know, being good for the soul, I think that's sort of an interesting...
Yeah. He does kind of, I think probably, I'm sure, like... being of Irish descent, like there was an element of that.
Yes, there's much.
And also, and I think Dorian Gray also has like a moment like this, right? Mm-hmm. Where he is fed up with his life of debauchery and sin, and he decides, and I mean Oscar Wilde, but this also happens in the book. But Oscar Wilde, it does have these moments where he kind of flirts with becoming a Catholic. Which again, you know, in a Protestant society was like a very extreme reaction.
I think he had a Catholic funeral, if I read my notes correctly. Like I said,
I think he might have. I've been to his grave in Paris. It's
I
really
have too.
Pretty.
They have to glass it off now. Because so many people would deface that
when
and Jim Morrison.
When I saw it, you could go right up and touch it and everything.
Yeah, yeah. Those were the days back in the '90s when let's talk about the book. We have Dorian Gray. He is in the book, he's blonde and blue eyed. He's
there is a very vivid, lengthy
description.
Lingering description.
Of his hotness.
The beauty of this young man.
I'm thinking like a Skarsgård type, just very, very handsome, blonde. And he goes into very deep descriptions about this. He's about 20 years old, let's just say, and he's having his portrait taken. And the man who's doing his portrait is in love with him. And just, you know, everybody's in love with him. He learns through Lord Henry Wotton, Lord Henry, who's sort of like this wealthy gadabout, you know, goes about in society, stirs trouble. He's there to kind of...
He's a troublemaker.
Yeah.
He's a gentleman of leisure, you know, or leisure.
Trust fund kid.
He's married, but, you know, he does... We should say, women are not even, like, really people in this book.
Or in his stories. And the things he says about women... Okay, and we're feminists, but sometimes I had a crack up, because it's at least clever. If you're going to insult me, at least be clever.
It's so anti-woman that... I know it gets to its where it's funny. I mean, you're like... Dang. Calm me out. Calm down. It's really...
Sorry you're not in the 21st
brutal
century.
To women. But it's also brutal to men. We should say that. But, I
he's
mean, because that's just who he is. But Lord Henry, and Lord Henry has a wife. And, you know, the other thing we should say, too, is about Oscar Wilde that's kind of interesting is, yes, he was this celebrated figure... among the Victorian aristocracy, where you had these very, you know, like a caste system practically of society. But he was not from that background, really. And so the book is also very much a skewering of that class. And he's so clever and so creative that he's basically, you know, this story is such a smash hit. He's making fun of these people right to their faces, and they are just lapping it up. So Lord Henry is one of these people that, like, he just has money. He doesn't have to worry about anything. He's married. You know, he has a say in government, but he doesn't really do anything.
No, like a Tom Wolfe character.
He's just a hedonist.
Yeah. You know, like Tom Wolfe to describe people in the 80s.
Right.
In those novels. It's the same thing. Like, who are these people that think they're so whatever? And Truman Capote sometimes...
Absolutely, yes.
That got him in trouble in the end when he got a little too close to the real people he was lampooning.
Right. I mean, and arguably that contributed to Wilde's downfall as well, that some people were just a little fed up with his mouth.
He was very mouthy. So Lord Henry Walton just basically says to Dorian Gray, boy, you're so beautiful. Gosh, it's going to really stink when you get older, isn't it? Like, you're just never going to be this good looking again. And you're never just, it's just once.
Too bad. It's all downhill from here.
Yes, exactly. That's the best thing anybody could ever possibly have. And you have it. And then you're going to lose it. And it's going to be miserable. Anywho, talk to you later. And this portrait is completed. This artist is completely in love with him. His daughter is completely in love with him. She's watching them, you know, paint it. And Dorian Gray, in the book, he just makes a deep, dark wish. I never want to get older than this painting. I never want to look worse than this painting. I want to look like this forever. And so he has this portrait out. And like I said, handsome guy. Lots of people like to hang out with Dorian Gray and be his partner. And women love him. He plays piano.
He's not a bad guy.
No, he's just kind of a little conceited.
He's not the smartest guy.
No.
I mean, we kind of get that from the outset, and which is why, you know, he's posing for this portrait by a very famous, you know, the Basil is the artist, mm-hmm. who's supposed to be like super, super famous. And so he's posing for Basil. He doesn't really seem to be aware that Basil's in love with him. You know, he's just like kind of there because they're friends. And so when Lord Henry goes on and on about like, well, kid, too bad you're not going to look any better than this ever again. Dorian has never thought about this before. He's like, oh, well, this guy's right. No, man, what am I going to do? So, you know, he's not that smart. And but he's super cute and has this kind of innocent air about him. And he's got money.
Mm-hmm.
His background's a little weird. It's a little murky, but he's okay. I mean, for money, we're not worried about him. But it only is when Henry says this to him that it kind of plants this idea in his head that like, oh crap, like this is the only good thing I have, and it's like when you buy a car and it instantly starts to lose value.
It's never worth what
it was worth when you bought it. So he starts to kind of freak out. Yeah, and he has the little panic about it. And in fact, every time he sees this portrait that he has now, every time he sees it, it like makes him anxious because he keeps thinking about what Henry said. And Henry, let's talk about Henry, because Henry's like a terrible influence.
Yes.
Henry is like your worst friend.
He's a frenemy.
He's not a good friend. He's a frenemy.
Henry just wants him to lead a hedonistic lifestyle. He wants a buddy to like party with.
Exactly.
And this kid's got it. This kid's young. He's handsome. He's got money. He's a pretty decent piano player. People seem to like him. And he's like, he's much older than, I'd say like a good 20 years older than Dorian. So I'm sure he's just looking for a young buddy to attract peeps, you know, track party people. And he sort of plants the idea of, you know, life is about living and let's have some wine. Let's, you know, he never mentions chasing women. It's all like when they get women, it's
no.
It's so it's something else.
They're
completely.
They're sort of around. And we're led to believe that they're kind of soiled after these men are through with them. But it's really about the men. It's
yes.
really about the boys.
It's Victorian society. He meets a woman named Sybil Vane, and in the play, she's an actress, and she's a brilliant actress.
Yes. Okay, so here's number one difference between book and movie. In the book, even though we just went on about how like women are really treated like crap in this book, so Sybil Vane, in the movie, which we'll talk about in a minute, she's very lowbrow. Kind of a vaudevillian sort of a figure. In the book, she's a big deal. She's a big deal, legitimate stage actor who is an up-and-comer. You know, she's a young Meryl Streep of the Victorian era. And he sees her. He's not at a seedy you know, body burlesque place. He's in like a real theater, and he sees her on stage, and she's playing Julie. She's playing all the great
Shakespearean parts.
Yeah, Shakespearean kind of roles. So he falls in love with all of these roles that she's playing, really before he ever meets her.
And then they do meet, and she calls him her Prince Charming. That's how she refers to him. And they go out a few times, and they wind up having sex. They fall in love. And then he says to his friends, I'm dating the greatest girl. She's such a fabulous actress. You're going to be so jealous when you see her because she is so freaking talented and beautiful, and she loves me. And then the poor thing, she goes on stage, and she just stinks on ice. And it's heartbreaking. Okay.
Which is, for Oscar Wilde, is like the worst thing, is to be a bad artist, right?
Right, right.
So yeah, he sets this whole thing up. And what's so funny to me is that he's just in love with her. He like barely knows this woman. He goes and sees her on the stage, yeah. But as for herself, and she seems fine, you know. But he barely knows her. She literally doesn't know his name when he asks her to marry him. She does not even know his name. And and he goes to his friends and he's like, wait till you see this girl. He like talks her up, you know, for pages in the book. And he plays it up and plays it up and plays it up and plays it up. And when he takes his two friends, Lord Henry and Basil, the artist who painted the portrait, to see her, you know, she's like, oh, crap, he's here and he brought his swanky friends with him. And she gets nervous.
Well, she also tells him, I don't know if I could play these parts anymore because now I know what it's like to love you.
Yeah.
I can't love this character that I'm supposed to be acting with because I'm so in love with you. And then it bums him out. They leave early.
So he's embarrassed.
Yeah.
He's like embarrassed that this woman that he thought he loved and wanted to marry was not like killing it on the stage that night, that one time.
Right. And she said, well, I don't know if I can, and he immediately just drops her. He sends her a note. She's so upset that she dies by suicide because of her broken heart, because of what he said to her. And her brother is someone that wants to get revenge. There's that part that goes on, and then he goes back to his house and he realizes when he looks at his portrait that it's changed a little bit because
it looks mean.
It looks mean. He's got the meanness around his eyes now. And then that's when he realizes like, oh, I look the same way I look in the mirror, you know, but I am getting older. But when I do bad things, it doesn't show up on my face because my face is everything. It shows up on the picture. And his thing is, well, I'll just put the picture someplace where I don't have to look at it, and then I'll do what I want, and I'll just like
done and done.
Anyway, that's what he does. He's partying. He's going to the opium dens. There's lots in there about self-indulgence, about drug use, about multiple partners.
Yeah, and we're led to believe that he, along the way, he also is kind of ruining the lives of all of these so-called friends that he's picking up mm-hmm. here and there. So we meet several young men who, you know, were part of the aristocracy or they were great minds in this or that field. But then their lives are totally destroyed because of him and his influence, because their paths crossed with Dorian Gray and then it was all over.
Exactly. And then at one point, the original painter, Basil, sees what's happened to the portrait, and Basil says to him, oh my God, you've got to make right by God. This is terrible. This is wrong. I shouldn't have done this. No one should have, you know, this is bad.
Yeah.
Pray with me.
He's really a good, I mean, we established early on that he's very much in love with Dorian Gray, but he is trying to be a good friend. He's like, oh, this is, you know, he's worried about him. Mm-hmm. He's not like, oh my gosh, you're a monster, I need to get out of here. He's like, oh no, we have to fix this. We have to pray, you know. I'm here for you, man. I'm not gonna leave your side. I've got you. You know, don't worry. We're gonna do whatever we need to do to make this right. And Dorian's like, yeah, or.
I noticed this knife over here. and stabs him. And then he's like, now I've got this body that I got to do something with. So he recruits a friend to help him get rid of the body.
Yeah.
And then the friend is so grief-stricken and so feels so horrible about
traumatized.
It. Traumatized. He's traumatized, and he feels terrible. He then dies by suicide. So that's a couple, there's a few deaths that are under his belt. Then he starts to fall in love with the daughter of the painter. Is that just the movie?
That's the movie. In the book,
there's somebody else.
It's somebody else. It's somebody who's just like in the little village there.
Right.
He sort of has a flirtation with Gladys. And I can't remember in the book if she's the painter's, if she's related to the painter or if she's related to Lord Henry. I can't quite remember. But anyway.
Right.
Yeah, in the movie, you know, because again, we're pressed for time. They have to make it clear. They change a couple little things here and there. Anyway, so yeah, he decides, you know, he has another relationship with another. And years have gone by. Years are going by. We pick it up. We pick him up. He's 18 years later. He looks exactly the same. 18 years of like drug use. And
picture Paul Rudd.
Who knows what all
you know,
else.
Like,
he's just, Paul Rudd.
He's Paul Rudd. He's a wizard. He just has not aged.
So, he's like, they know him on a first name basis at the opium den. He's that guy. And at one point, Sybil's brother is
right.
in town. And he hears a woman call Dorian Prince Charming, which is what Sybil had called him. And he's like, that's the guy. So he goes after him and confronts him and is going to kill him. And Dorian's like, whoa. You know, it wasn't me, man.
Look at me. I can't possibly be old enough.
When did this happen?
Yeah.
How long ago?
I'm 20.
Look at my face.
Line free. It's no wrinkles, nothing. Look at this face. And then he does eventually, like just for time, he eventually does feel bad about what he's been doing. Like the painting just gets uglier and uglier and uglier.
It gets real bad.
It gets really, really bad.
Yeah.
And in the end, he decides that he needs to have an act of contrition, and that should be, to put a Catholic spin on it, that he needs to destroy this painting and that'll break the spell. And he's in a house and he has servants. He has to keep firing servants because they're like, what's up in the attic? And he's like, don't go to the attic.
How can you keep that room locked all the time?
I need a clean up.
Can I go in and clean it?
Something's up there. It's crazy. No,
you hired me to clean this house.
Right. So he goes up there, he sees the painting, and then one more time just confesses his sins, stabs the painting. People bust into the attic. They find him on the floor, and basically he's now an old man or a middle-aged man. That's old for England at the time. But he has the ugliness of the portrait, and then the portrait of itself looks young, and he's a young man. So it's just sort of like, at first they don't even recognize him because he's so disfigured. He's so,
right.
Like, I think they recognize him by his fingers because his face.
His rings.
So, yes.
Yeah, his jewelry. Because he doesn't look anything like, I mean, they just saw him.
Right.
And he looks like that painting that's there. And the painting is now restored to what it originally looked like.
Exactly.
Dun, dun, dun.
Yeah.
So that's the story. I mean, it must have been great. I can imagine, like, waiting for the next issue of Lippincott Magazine to come out. To find out, like, what was going to happen next.
All these great writers, that's what they did. Because publishing was a nightmare. I mean, you made more money in magazines than you would with a book publishing. Because they would lose the rights to these things. And so, let's just say this comes out. And there's been so many versions of this story.
Oh, I don't even know how many.
And it's a standard joke people have when you see somebody who looks young. Do they have a picture in the attic that looks really... I mean, if you've ever heard that joke, you're wondering, what is that? That's the joke. But so many versions over the years, but we decided to stick with the classic. It's streaming everywhere, and it was nominated for several awards. And that's when we have our 1945 version, directed and written by Albert Lewin. And they made a few changes from book to movie, but let's play the trailer first.
The picture could change, and I could be always what I am now. For that, I would give everything. There's nothing in the whole world I would not give. I'd give my soul for that.
The vain jealousy which prompted Dorian Gray to utter this fateful prayer was destined to sweep him into a life so fraught with vice and evil that its marks became horrible to behold. For the mad wish of Dorian Gray was granted through some supernatural miracle. And day by day, he watched his sins etch themselves upon his painted portrait, while he himself stayed young and handsome. Every vile thought and act, every criminal deed, left its mark upon the painted canvas that was to bear the burden of his shame. Down to depths of degradation frightful to conceive went Dorian Gray, seeking new outlets to satisfy his passion for pleasure. His extraordinary visits into the strange world of crime and sin became notorious. And when he reappeared again in society, men would whisper to each other in corners or look at him with searching eyes. Women, who for his sake had set convention at defiance, were seen to grow pale if Dorian Gray entered the room. What was this strange fascination this man held for everybody? To what limits of evil did he drag those he knew? Men and women alike, all fell under the spell of his charm, and yet to know him was to court shame and disaster.
My question, Margot, is what do you think of Herb Hatfield as our Dorian Gray?
You know, I had to think about it a little bit. Because at first I was like, what's he doing? He's not really doing anything. But, you know, I've also seen, I went and looked for like other stuff that he had done. And I see now that that was probably direction, like the direction was that he should be, which is a little different from the book. In the book, Dorian Gray is, he's young and impetuous and, again, not real smart. And so he is quite emotional. Like he, that's why he kind of has what we would say today, impulse control problems. But in the movie, the Dorian Gray in the movie, as it goes on and he becomes more and more evil, he becomes kind of like icy. He goes from being just sort of, I would say, stoic to being just like ice water in his veins. Mm-hmm. You know, no, like a sociopath, pretty much. And at first I was like, I don't know about the job he's doing, but I think it's the direction. I think that's what he was directed to do.
I think so too. Yeah. I mean, he looks different. He has dark hair.
Which is fine.
I mean, it's a black and white movie. Yeah. And he's beautiful.
Yeah.
We have George Saunders as Lord Henry, we talked about him when we talked about All About Eve. He's such a great actor. His voice is just...
For those of you who didn't hear that episode, he is the one who plays the caustic theater critic in All About Eve. So very good with the Wildian dialogue,
right? The one-liners, and then we have in this version we have Angela Lansbury plays Sybil Vine, who was 20 years old when she made this.
She is American treasure, but she is a global treasure.
Yes.
I know she's not an American citizen, but I feel like she belongs to us. Whenever I am feeling blue, I'll just cuddle up and watch episode after episode of Murder, She Wrote. I just love her.
That was my mother's
so much.
Favorite show ever.
I freaking love that
show. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
I adore it. And it's only because of her. She's so pretty.
Yes.
And,
she's like a doll. She's so tiny and pretty.
She just looks like a little doll.
Yeah.
Yeah. And she's so talented. You know, she plays this character who's different than in the book. You know, in the book, she's like I said, she's like this big deal, kind of up and coming, highbrow kind of actress. In the movie, she's playing this lowbrow, you know, neighborhood kind of community pub slash theater sort of thing. But she's trying, you know, she has ambitions, she has talent, like she is genuinely talented. And she's just angelic. And,
yeah.
And you really buy, I mean, it's amazing, but you really buy when Dorian Gray shows up and sees her and falls in love with her, you know, even though he's very withdrawn and icy performance wise. And again, I do think that's what the direction was. When she falls in love with him, like, you really buy it. You really buy that she's, like, fallen for this guy.
It's wonderful. Did you write it?
Frédéric Chopin wrote it. For a woman he loved. Her name was George Sand. Someday I'll tell you about
her. I should like that.
What did music mean to you?
I don't know. It is full of emotion. But it's not happy.
No, it's not happy.
Why was he unhappy?
Perhaps because he felt his youth slipping away from him.
What an odd thing for you to say.
Why?
You are so young.
Yeah. And you also.
What is the music called? Has it a name?
Kind of name. It is called Prelude.
He, in his way, has fallen for her, but it's different. You know, it's not a reciprocal relationship. It's so wonderful. It's just. I love every moment that she's on the screen.
What's the name of the song, the bird song that she does?
Something, the yellow bird?
Yeah, I remember.
Something like that?
There's a clip on YouTube of her singing that on Murder, She Wrote.
Oh, yeah, I know, I remember. It's great.
But yeah.
They were friends for the rest of their lives.
They both moved to Ireland. She raised her kids after she was a Manchurian candidate. One of her kids almost got messed up with Charles Manson, and she and her husband packed him up and sent him to, they all moved to Ireland, and that's where she stayed for a very long time. She doesn't fool around, but that he had a house there too. We're talking about her in Hatfield. They were friends forever. George Saunders is here. Peter Lawford is a character that I don't think is from the book. He's sort of David Stone.
Oh, Peter Lawford, you mean?
Yeah. What did I say?
Yeah. George Sanders. Peter Lawford, who, have we talked about Peter Lawford before?
I can't remember.
Maybe briefly when we talked about Little Women.
Maybe he's that's Little it. Women. Yeah, he is.
Maybe. You know, I always think of him as one of the Rat Pack, but, you know, very handsome. Another thing about this movie, it has like every single British actor in the state of California is in this movie. I think only Herd Hatfield, there's only like two of them that are not British, but like all of the character actors are British. All of the, like, even like the extras, I mean, everybody is British. So anybody who was like remotely British in Hollywood is in this movie. And so Peter Lawford, which I think it's a good role. This character is not in the book at all, but it does help the narrative of the movie along quite a bit. So you have this little subplot about the painter's niece in the movie. She's his niece, whose name is Gladys, And as we see her first as a little girl when the painting's being completed, and she's super cute, and she's got like this little crush on Dorian.
And she puts her little initials under the signature. So cute. Donna Reed plays her.
Yeah.
Oh, she's so beautiful.
Donna Reed is crazy pretty. Mm-hmm. And she's very talented too. I read somewhere that she had wanted to play Sybil. She's a little annoyed that she didn't get the part of Sybil.
Yeah, Angela Lansbury, she got this part, and I forget the other part, but she got them all in like a couple of days. Like her, and she was 20, like I said, just does her own singing, does a great job. She had been Broadway. Because
she
for
does
years.
Everything.
She can do everything. I think she's a wizard too.
And she
too.
Catches criminals.
And she just got her birthday recently. Yeah, she's a wizard too. But he falls in love with Sybil, and they bring the friends. And George Saunders is much more malevolent. He's just sort of like, well, if he falls in love, I'm not going to have a life. So I'm going to have to ruin it for him. And he convinces him to first of all, they do have a relationship. She comes to the house and they make out. I mean, he plays piano, he plays Chopin. They talk a little
tame.
Bit. Very tame. I mean, this is 1945. But George Saunders realized, like, oh, this guy's probably really in love with this girl. And it's kind of odd, I think, but he tells her, like, I need you to leave right now. What would you do if I told you to leave right now?
And yeah, okay. This is not in the book at all, we should say.
Yeah.
In the movie, yeah, Lord Henry has this... Lord Henry is worried about losing his, like, wingman.
Mm-hmm. I'm trying to, yeah.
And it's sort of like, it reminded me of in Dangerous Liaisons.
Yes.
Where Glenn Close's character is like, well, you know, you need to dump her and you should dump her like this. Like, tell her this and then do that. And that's what Lord Henry does to Dorian Gray in this movie. In the book, she goes on stage and chokes, right?
Right.
And Dorian Gray is like, I can't believe you were so terrible on stage. It's over.
Yeah.
And she kills herself. It's terrible. So that's not what happened. You know, so it's a very different, like the circumstances of Sybil's death are totally different. I think I would argue in the book that he's crueler in the book than he is even in the movie. Because he's embarrassed that her art was bad. Basically.
He can't live with that. Yeah.
And not only that, like, again, the book is so brutal to women.
Yes.
So she kills herself.
Here.
And wait, she kills herself. And I can't remember if it might even be the painter, Basil. It's either Basil or Lord Henry. When they find out, they were like, oh, I mean, I knew she was a bad actress, but jeez.
Can't take any criticism, could she?
But in this version, yeah, Lord Henry's like, oh man, I'm gonna lose my buddy.
Yeah.
And so yeah, so he's like, you know, what you need to do is you need to test her before you marry her. And so try to get her to spend the night. And then if she does, you know she's bad news and garbage and you should get rid of her. And if she doesn't, well, yeah, then go right ahead and marry her. And so he, like, basically does everything he can to guilt Sybil into staying, which she does. She has nothing.
Yeah. Angela Lansbury just cries in this scene. Ugh. And it's so heartbreaking.
It's heartbreaking.
But then she dies. And then her brother wants to avenge her death. He's a sailor and has to go to Australia. But, you know, he keep him in the back of your mind because he's somebody that wants to take care of this. And then Gladys grows up and that's Donna Reed. And then she's in love with him.
She's in love with him. Peter Lawford is this character who's just in the movie. He's this other guy who was in love with Gladys.
Right.
So Peter Lawford is in love with Donna Reed. But Donna Reed only has eyes for icy Herd Hatfield.
Exactly. He breaks off their engagement. Like, they get engaged and then he breaks off their engagement and she confronts him. And the movie is really interesting in that it's black and white. It's shot beautifully and it did win an Academy Award for cinematography, and the art direction is insane. It's really great. When they show the portrait and you full on get the full on idea of what it looks like, you know, when he's really gone mad, it's jarring because it just goes into Technicolor. Like right away, it's full color.
Yeah, I think it's three or four times we see the portrait and it's the only thing that's in color and it is very jarring. It's a nice touch. I think it's a really good effect.
Yeah. And I forgot to mention, there's a scene. So the brother comes back and he's going to avenge the death. And then there's this scene where they're fox hunting and rabbit hunting out in the woods. And the brother is in the woods and gets shot at and killed. And it's just so happens they shot him. Like, why did he go in the middle of a fox hunt to kill somebody? There's lots of guns everywhere. But they're like, who is this guy? And he knows exactly who this guy is. But he's getting crazier and crazier. And he gets engaged to Gladys. And then he's going to break up with Gladys because he just can't deal with her leaving him, but he can't keep the lie going. And they go to the house. He's up in the room. He's like, yes, I'm going to stab this portrait. And he does. And then Peter Lawford, all of them come running into the room. The portrait is fine. And the old person on the floor that he's supposed to be is now crumpled on the floor. So it's the morality play.
Yes.
The Faustian bargain that he made.
There it is.
And that's it.
And that's the movie.
Yep.
It's great. I mean, the art direction is terrific. You know what I did? The other thing I forgot. I completely forgot about this. I have seen that. I've spent a lot of time in front of that painting. The Ivan Albright one, the second one.
Mm-hmm.
Ivan Albright is today he's a fairly well-known American artist. But yeah, back in the mid to late 90s when I worked at the Met, we had a retrospective. There was a little retrospective of Ivan Albright's work. So yes, I've seen that painting up close quite a bit.
It's in Chicago now. It's at the Chicago, I think it's at the Chicago Art Institute. Am I correct?
I believe the Chicago Art Institute owns that work. Yes.
I was just in Chicago and I didn't get to go to the Art Institute. I have to go next time because
his paintings are really extraordinary. I mean, and that one is it's so unsettling because it's huge. I mean, you see it in the movie. It's very large. Mm-hmm. Ivan Albright's a very interesting figure. I don't know that he was that well known at this time, you know, when he did this painting. How can I put this? His wife was super wealthy. His father was actually a well-known artist. And so he didn't really have to, like, be hustling too much, you know, during this time. But he's super talented, you know, and kind of over the years, he's sort of a slow burn. Like over the years, he's gotten more and more respect as an artist. He's just extraordinarily gifted. His twin brother, Malvin Albright, was also a painter. And originally, the two twins painted the two portraits. So Malvin painted the original one, and Ivan painted the before and the after. Mm-hmm. But I don't remember. There was a reason. I don't know if they switched the actor that was playing the role. There was some reason they didn't end up using Malvin's portrait of the before one, and they went with the one that's in the movie, which is now in a private collection somewhere. But yeah, I mean, originally it was these two. It was really neat. Like these two twins were painting these two portraits, and they did like a whole little publicity thing about it. You can find pictures of the two twins working on them.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. But Ivan Albright's a very well respected painter. And yeah, if you do have an opportunity to see that work in the Chicago Art Institute, please, please do, because it's very unsettling.
Well, so between book and movie, which did you like?
Oh, book.
Yeah, right. Oh, that's not even
book. I mean, the movie is very good. I thought the casting was good. They all the roles that they pulled, all these British actors. I don't know where they scooped them up in California, but they got all of them. I love the lighting in this. I think it's really good. All the sets are excellent. I like the choice of having Sybil be in the little kind of vaudeville scenario instead of like the fine art theater backdrop. I thought that was a really good choice. I liked the whole, I really liked the whole like device of Peter Lawford as David, because he's the one that kind of is the final kind of gets the thing sewn up. And then, like, Gladys, therefore, has a happy ending because you kind of get the impression that she's going to end up with him. So I really loved the choices that were made. The paintings are great. But the book is just fantastic.
There are so many versions. I mean, obviously, we couldn't talk about all of them. And I mean, I'm interested in seeing other ones. I did see one with Peter Finch. And it was The Trial of Oliver, of Oscar Wilde.
Oh, yes. I remember that movie. Yes. It's not bad.
It's not bad. Like I said, I had like an Oscar Wilde night on YouTube. Yeah.
The Stephen Fry one is, I think, the quintessential like biopic of Oscar Wilde. It's very good.
Yeah. Should we tell them what we're going to do next? What we have coming up?
Yeah, let's, because I can't remember.
Oh, okay. So
I all last week until Monday, I was on antibiotics and they really mess with my mind. I've been a day off all week. Every day, I think it's the day before. And so like my trash didn't get picked up this week because I thought it was Tuesday when it was Wednesday.
Margo had dental surgery.
I did. Ugh. It's fine. It's, you know, it's healing. And I'm glad I got it done, but it was pretty gnarly.
Well, we're going to redo one that we did a long time ago.
That's right.
We're going to redo The Bad Seed. It's a great movie. It's an awesome book. I super remember loving this.
Oh, it's so good.
If you want to listen to the old version that we did like 5 or 6 years ago, it's on the Patreon page. I'm sure it's for free, but we're going to do it up great. And then we have a fun idea for November. We're going to cover Disney in November.
Yes, this was a suggestion that came up in our Facebook group, and it's a great idea. We've never done this before. What a great theme for Thanksgiving month.
It'll be so much fun. So please send us your suggestions there. And once again, it has to be stuff that we can get our hands on. So if it's out of print or whatever, not so much, but something that we can get on the Libby app or Kindle or whatever. And please follow us on all the things. Thank you so much to Joe for signing up on our Patreon page. And Margo, where can they find you?
You can find me online at coloniabook.com, and all of my social media callouts are at She's Not Your Mama. And where can they find you?
You could find me at Brooklyn Fit Chick for Twitter and Instagram. And my site is brooklynfitchick.com. Thank you all very much for listening. We will be back soon with The Bad Seed.
The snow was very plentiful.
Thank you so much for listening to the Book vs. Movie podcast. We are a part of the Frolic Podcast Network. You can find more podcasts you will love at frolic.media/podcasts. We follow the hashtags Lady Pod Squad and Potter and Family. If you want to support the show, you can go to our Patreon page, go to PATREON, and look for Book vs. Movie Podcast. We have a basic Facebook page, but we also have a private Facebook group. Go to Facebook and type in Book vs. Movie Podcast Group if you want to join that. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Book vs. Movie. Spell all those words out. If you'd like to send us an email, it's Book vs. Movie Podcast, spell that all out, at gmail.com. We do have to follow Margot D at Brooklyn Fit Chick on social media, and Margot P at She's Nacho Mama. Thanks so much again for checking out our show, and we'll be back soon with a new episode.
I'll gladly introduce you, sir, but she's proud. She won't meet anybody. My delightful dove, descend and make a pilgrimage with me among these mortals.
The spoiled and petted yellow bird could scarce believe it true that a common sparrow should refuse a bird with blood so blue. He told her the advantages of riches and of gold. She answered that her liberty for gold could not be sold. She said, I must be going, but he cried, no, no, it's snowing, and the wintry winds do blow. Stay with me, my little dearie, for without you 'twould be dreary. But she owned
Say the word and I'll take you backstage.
Thank you, no.